Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I am delighted to be speaking with Pastor Henry Hildebrandt, whose name will no doubt be familiar to many of you since the Canadian truckers' protests in Ottawa, and more of that in just a moment. Henry Hildebrandt is the pastor in the Church of God Aylmer, Ontario, Canada, which is a Christian non-denominational church with many congregations around the world that seek to live out and testify to the gospel of Jesus Christ in a faithful and authentic way. And the website for that church can be found at churchofgod.com. Pastor Hildebrandt, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the program.
You're very welcome, Julian. It's so nice to be here with you.
It's a great privilege to be speaking with you, because over the last several weeks, I've been following your Facebook page and watching the videos that you've been putting there of your time in Ottawa with the truckers' protest. And I've been hugely impressed and indeed moved by your ministry there, the way in which you've given support to so many people in really difficult circumstances, praying with them, pastoring them, always preaching peace and identifying with the protesters and their cause. And most moving for me, actually, when I was watching you, the way that you many times prayed for the police out loud right in front of them, you know, calling them to listen to their consciences and lay down their batons and join the protest. So, as I say, a great privilege to be speaking with you today. So thank you. So let's start with how you became involved with that truckers' protest. Were you involved right from the beginning of that, or did you somehow get drawn into it once it had started?
To make a long story short, what happened is, because of our church involvement over the past 2 years, because of the COVID-19 narrative, our church had some issues with the local police and whatnot, because they wanted to shut our building down, and eventually did lock the building, and then after a few months unlocked it again. Because of that, we were already involved with other protests, whether it was Toronto or somewhere else. We were standing up for our God-given freedom. So then when I heard that the truckers were starting in Western Canada, they were starting a convoy, I felt immediately in my heart, I felt that I needed to connect with the people, because my name, because of what our church had gone through, my name was already out there. And I felt that these truckers automatically would expect that a pastor would be supporting them and helping them, because their cry is for their freedom. And like I said, I couldn't stay home. I told my wife, I said, I need to pack for overnight. I need to go to Ottawa, because I know that we will need to stand with them, because their cry resonates with the rest of the world. And when I saw them, when I saw the convoy making their way from Western Canada across Canada, and I saw the overpasses and bridges filled with people beside the road, I knew right then and there the message of this convoy is resonating with the rest of the people. It's that they are crying because of oppression. And that drew me to Ottawa. And like I said, I made my way there with other people that went with me. And what we thought was an overnight trip to Ottawa lasted 3 weeks.
3 weeks, yes. And as you say, it was a team of you who were out there. How many of you went from your church?
So it wasn't not a large group, but we filled up one vehicle. So there was like five or six of us. And then what happened is, because our church is about, it's not that far, so it's about 6 hour drive, but 6 hours from Ottawa. So what the church people did is, I stayed in Ottawa with a couple of brothers from the church, and the other people from the church came, went back and forth. They went back for the week to work, and for the weekend they came back to Ottawa to support what I was doing in Ottawa.
So you didn't, they didn't have to put up with all the cold all the time. Just how cold was it in Ottawa? I can't imagine. Looking at it, it looked pretty Arctic, really.
So I have never experienced a cold like this. Canada, it's cold, but I guess I just never experienced that you are staying out in the cold for hours. So I had never in my life before used hand warmers and feet warmers, these little packages that you buy in the store. They kind of they get activated. So I had never done that. And when I got to Ottawa, I realized very soon I will need another jacket on top of everything that I already wear. So got myself a big Parker, a big jacket. And with that, trying to keep warm and put some real boots on and whatnot. But it was so it reached like minus 25, 28 degrees. And then during the day, it warmed up a bit, but some days not a lot. So it was bitter, bitter cold. But it seemed to me that that made the cry even stronger, that in the dead of winter, these people would be there. And some of them were there with their families. They brought their families in their truck. So it was quite something.
Yes, indeed. Well, we thought it was the end of the world when it got to minus 10 here a few years back. That's ridiculous. We'll talk about the police in a little bit, but I do want to ask, you know, when that fuel was confiscated by the police, did anybody suffer very much through not being able to heat their cabins and the like?
So, as you know, it was quite the stir when we heard that they were there. I was already in my hotel room retiring for the day, trying to get some rest. And all of a sudden, the call came out that there's an attack by the Ottawa police at the station where they had the food and the fuel. So we all just jumped up and into our boots and jackets and drove over there, which was a few minute drive. It was just on the outskirts of Ottawa. And we went over there. And when we arrived, we saw it was just loaded with police, and they were circling in the whole thing and trying to start to confiscate propane tanks. And they brought the city of Ottawa in with their truck to hook onto the little tank. So we go by liters here. So it was a 3,000 liter, what would that be, like a 700 gallon tank of diesel fuel that was there for the trucks. They hooked that onto the truck and dragged it out of there. And that's where I had the opportunity to pray for the police and speak to them.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing is, I'll just quickly add here, the amazing thing was that evening when I had the opportunity there to preach to them a little bit and speak to them, and I saw how God's presence was there, I felt how God was dealing with their souls. And that very evening, the sergeant of one of the groups of the police that was there, that evening he resigned from his job and said he couldn't do it no longer.
I see.
Anyway.
Can I just ask you, was he one of those people who was actually present when you were praying with them, praying for them?
That is correct. He was right there on site. He was right there. He was the sergeant of one of the groups there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then when they left, the way this, Charles, the way this, I'm sorry, I'm calling you by your last name, Julian, the way this convoy worked, you have never seen, or I'm assuming you have never seen, a group of people working together like this convoy, these people did. So the fuel was shared, the food was shared. And when they took this tank of fuel, they worked, the people worked through the night. And by the time morning came around, they had it all set up again. They knew where their fuel was. There was a lot more fuel, not very far from there. It was in a secret location, but I have never in my life seen people coming together so quickly and so strongly and so united and in such a neighborly way and such a working together. It was fascinating. It gave me so much hope to see what humanity actually is capable of doing once the situation arises.
Well, even from all this distance away, I had the same sort of feeling as well, watching those videos, you know, once it had been said that the fuel was being taken, and then there was this warning that it was illegal for anybody to help out with fuel, all that sort of thing. And then I saw this video of lots of people carrying these cans just en masse, and I thought, well, you know, what can the police do in such a situation? It was very heartwarming, indeed.
That was amazing. I believe it was the following day. Mm-hmm. I believe the stores all ran out of those, we call them jerry cans.
Uh-huh.
So everywhere, women and children, elderly, everybody was carrying a jerry can as a symbol. Mm-hmm. It was a symbol of saying, we will not be defeated. Mm-hmm. We will bring fuel to the truckers regardless. And that's what happened. So the police then confiscated some of the jerry cans. They confiscated on site right there by the Parliament building. They confiscated some of the little wagons that the people were using to haul the fuel. But it did not matter. People then hid the fuel among the garbage bags, the trash there somewhere. They had the jerry cans there. But the police backed off right away. They saw it was a lost cause. Mm. There's no way. And the whole world was watching.
Yes.
And it was such a mockery. I'm sorry, but it was such a mockery for the police that they would try to take the fuel and the food. And then when the police chief said, I knew right away, in my mind, I knew when the police chief said that he would not hesitate to start a criminal investigation into anyone that would give food to the truckers or fuel. In my mind, I knew it's over. His days are numbered, and it was so. Later on, I heard that the night that he confiscated the fuel, that was his last command, and he lost his job over the police chief.
Yes, yes. The unjust nature of that, the inhumanity of that ruling was just absolutely apparent, wasn't it? Yes, indeed. So, yes, it was incredibly wonderful to see that, as you say, that symbolic act there that just said, no, we're standing for our humanity and our God-given rights. It was wonderful. Can you just explain something about the original triggers for this protest? And when we've heard that it was about objections to COVID-19 vaccine mandates and cross-border vaccine passports. Could you say anything more about what triggered this?
Yes. So, Julian, what happened is for the past 2 years since the COVID narrative was prevailing everywhere, the truckers were not affected. They faithfully brought the food across. And as you know, the United States and Canada, they are each other's biggest trading partners, obviously. Mm. So the trucks were going back and forth, not an issue. The vaccine was not mandatory for them. And then lo and behold, at the very end of this, as the provinces of Canada are already throwing off away the mandates, all of a sudden, the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau introduced and said that he would require that the truckers would need to be vaccinated, or if they were not, then they would have to quarantine for 14 days as soon as they come back into the country. Wow. And that's what sparked it. And then the Biden administration in the United States followed suit the following week. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back, like they say. The truckers just said, look, we have not been affecting anyone. We were fine for the past 2 years. Why are you attacking us now? And they said, we are going to start a convoy and see what we can do.
Hmm. And reports were saying there were up to, because that's always a bit of a vague term, isn't it? But up to 50,000 truckers involved in this protest. Was it anywhere near that? Have you any idea what the involvement was?
So it was very hard to keep track, because as they made their way from the Western Canada, as they made their way to the capital, more convoys added. So it was thousands of trucks. And when they arrived in Ottawa, not nearly all of them could even come near the city. It was just a flood of trucks everywhere.
Mm. So that was camping out in front of the Parliament buildings there in Ottawa, and there was a lot of honking of horns going on. I believe it was 10 minutes of horn honking. Was it every hour? Is that right?
That's correct. On the hour, and then at the half hour, it was less, a few minutes less.
Okay.
And then on the hour again. So that honking will ring in my ears, I don't know, probably for the rest of my life.
Yes, it was quite eerie sounding, actually. Was that throughout the night as well?
So at the beginning, when they got there, it was throughout the night, just whenever. And then the judge in Ottawa ruled that they could not do that because of the residents there. So then the truckers did immediately go by that ruling and did not honk during the night at all.
Because these were the objections, weren't there, that people were being relentlessly bothered by this noise. And of course, also that the economy of the city was being affected. And of course, more widely, that the economy of Canada was being affected by this. What do you think of those kinds of objections? Do you think they have any force?
So that was the issue for 3 weeks that I was there. That's what we heard. Like, we heard from inside the parliament, the parliamentarians, the prime minister, he would tell the world, or try to tell the world, how evil this was and how much vandalism there was and how much hatred there was. And they were carrying the swastika flags and you name it. He just called it all these different names. And we were just a few meters away. We were just a few yards away. I was just on the other side of the fence, knowing that it was total lies, because I was right there, boots on the ground. I knew there was zero vandalism. I knew that the streets of Ottawa were being cleaned instantly as soon as the convoy got there, because they picked up all the trash, all the garbage. There was nothing laying around. People were going around with garbage bags every day, all day, picking up things. So the lies that were coming from the parliament were so obvious. The world was able to see by the videos that were produced by myself and others that were on the ground the world could see that it was the opposite. There was no vandalism. There was no swastika flags at all. None. Mm. Not one time. There was nothing that at all. It was just a loving community like I've never seen.
Mm. Well, I did see one video of somebody in a balaclava carrying a Confederate flag, and then when they were asked, hello, are you with us, or whatever, the person just sort of sloped off into the background, so I don't know anything about that. Do you know anything about that?
That's what I heard. I did not see it myself. I heard that there had been one Confederate flag, so, and they were asked not to do that, and apparently they left. So I have, in the 3 weeks, like I said, I've never seen any of it.
No. It was pretty trivial, whatever it was. And what about members of Parliament? I think some did speak up, did they not, in favour of what was happening, but most remained silent, I believe.
So in the Canadian government, without me going into a lot of details, there's the Conservative Party and there's the Liberal Party and then there's the NDP Party. Those are the three main parties. So during our 3 weeks in Ottawa, what happened is the Conservative Party, which they would call it the Blue Party, for the most part, if not all of them, they did side with the truckers and said that they should have their right to a peaceful protest as it was. Uh-huh. But then the other two, which makes the majority, the Liberal Party and the NDP Party, they joined up together against, and therefore they, whenever there was a vote about it, they always had the majority because those two parties stuck together.
Oh, okay. And of course, the response to this in the middle of February was Justin Trudeau invoking this Emergencies Act, which was put place in the 1980s, wasn't it, to give extraordinary government powers to deal with various kinds of emergency. Now, my understanding is that Emergency Act has not been used except for this one occasion. Is that right?
It had never been invoked before, never before. Before it was called the martial law.
Yes.
It has never been used when he used it now. And the interesting thing was he used it at the end of the situation. Once the trucks were going home, once this thing was being cleaned up, he used it at the very end of it. And it was no surprise to us that 2 days later he revoked it again or took it back because there was no reason to have it.
But that was in order to enable the police to do these extraordinary things, was it not?
Well, he claimed that that's what it was.
Right.
But the necessity was never there because there was no violence. And that's what they said is the police found it extremely difficult to deal with this crowd because the police are trained how to deal with violent people. They're not trained how to deal with a peaceful protest because a peaceful protest doesn't need police aggression. That's what made it very, very difficult. And that's why the whole world basically frowned on it, him using the Emergency Act, because it was not an emergency.
Yes. Yes, I have a quote here from the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. They say that this law creates a high and clear standard for good reason. The Act allows government to bypass ordinary democratic processes. They say this standard has not been met. And then they note an alarm about it. They say it threatens our democracy and our civil liberties. Do you agree with that statement by them?
Absolutely. And I think it was extremely important that that association put that forward, because what you saw immediately after that, as soon as the Prime Minister invoked the Emergency Act, you saw him going about and freezing people's bank accounts and whatnot, which he could not have done without the Emergency Act. But there was no reason for him to freeze those accounts. And that's why a few days after that, he saw the backlash coming from the public, from the world. Mm-hmm. He quickly went back and unfroze those accounts.
Right. So there are no frozen accounts now. Is that right?
So my understanding, I can't confirm this, but my understanding is that there is still a couple of accounts that are frozen, which would be those of the main leaders involved.
Mm-hmm. That was pretty frightening, actually, I think, for everybody to read about that, because, of course, this does bring up very much the dangers of the cashless society, which, of course, many of us have been talking about for a long time. Once we go fully digital, once we go programmable digital money, then, you know, our lives can be switched off in this way. I think it serves, actually, doesn't it, as a huge warning to the world.
Very, very alarming, Julian. Very alarming. Mm. And I guess I had not thought about it the first day that they were freezing these accounts. I thought, yeah, I guess they are going about. But then I realized when they went further and they froze the accounts of people that had donated to the convoy. So now you have huge investors, big. You're not talking just people off the street and the poor people that donated $20, but this now involves people having their accounts frozen that are investors in Canada. So, and that's why you saw a major wave going through the Canadian banks, And I'm sure they begged the prime minister to quickly do something, because the banking system was threatened that it would collapse, because people were lining up along the streets, people going in all day long, taking their money out everywhere. And investors were saying, you know what, I think we'll have to invest somewhere else. Canada's not the place. He had not expected that.
Mm-hmm. And can I just go back to the police just for a moment? I had some impression there was a little bit of heavy-handedness. I don't know whether one would call it violence, but certainly heavy-handedness by the police. I saw somebody being knocked down by a baton. There was some tear gas, I believe. One or two people knocked down by mounted police. Did that characterize what was going on, or was that the exception? Just a few cases here and there.
So throughout the 3 weeks, the police were just kind of walk through the crowds and just try to pick up some jerry cans with fuel and stuff, confiscate a couple of little wagons and stuff. Throughout the 3 weeks, I would say the police handled it fairly well. Like, it was, they weren't just overly friendly, but it was okay. They just kept peace there, and it worked, with a few exceptions, like I said, confiscating the fuel and whatnot. But overall, it worked. Mm. But where they overstepped was the last 2 days, when they aggressively came with hundreds of police, with riot gear, with mounted horses, and just rode through the crowd and knocked this grandma down off her walker and stepped on or damaged her shoulder and whatnot. So that was very heavy-handed when they did that the last couple of days.
Yes. And is it right that a lot of these people, these police that were brought into the area, is it right they were volunteers for that role?
I understand that it was all volunteers. I understand that they were asked back home, back where they, at their locality, they were asked if they wanted to volunteer. And of course, it came with a high wage that they paid them for coming. But I understand it was all volunteers.
Oh, that's very interesting, because what that says to me, right, you may not want to comment on this, but it says to me that that might be in a way to weed out those who would have sympathized with the protesters if it was done by volunteering. But just the thought that occurred to me.
I absolutely think that there's a real reason for thinking that, because that's what it appeared when they approached the crowd. It appeared that there was not many that would have sympathized, even though the crowd was begging them to please, please stand up for our God-given freedom. Stand up for the oath that you swore when you took on the job. Mm. So, but there was not a lot of sympathizing there at all.
Yes. This is very sad. Okay, let's turn again to a little bit more about your spiritual experience in that. You say that you were very aware of God's presence. Was that throughout the 3 weeks, or just at particular moments of particular high tension and drama?
I would say, Julian, that throughout the 3 weeks, first of all, like I said earlier, just a loving community, just such unity, just standing together. But beyond that, as one of the truckers said, he said when he arrived in Ottawa, he said God found him. He said the presence of God could be felt, and that's exactly what it was. I'll just give you a couple of quick examples here. Mm. One was when I left my motel room one time, 10 minutes before 7 o'clock in the evening. I left my motel room to do another round, to go through and spend some time with the truckers. As I left the room, I came out, and one trucker met me there, a young man, and he said, Pastor, would you be willing to pray with us? We'll have prayer meeting here right shortly. And I said, absolutely. So as we got there, there was, like, in a short time, we had like 20 men standing in a circle. Two of them didn't speak much English. They were French. They joined us, and we all joined hands and prayed the Lord's Prayer. And after that, they asked, Pastor, can you pray? So I prayed. And then a man drove by in a car, and he stopped and he said, I'm so nervous. It feels like tonight the police might attack us. And the trucker said, sir, step out of your car. Come, we are having prayer here right now. And the man stepped out of his car, and we prayed again. And the Frenchman prayed the Lord's Prayer in French. I'm just using it as an example to show you how how the presence of God, you could talk to about God to anybody at any time, anywhere, because people were just, the air was charged with, we want our God-given freedom back. We want God back in the government. We want government officials that recognize the supremacy of God. It was just a prevailing atmosphere with this.
Yeah, remarkable. And I picked up something of that because, of course, I saw you preaching there in front of the crowds. And it just occurred to me, I thought, well, surely it can't be that all those people are Christians. And yet there was that sense of people saying, you know, raising their hands and clapping and were with you in the message that you were making. And of course, you weren't using Christian language throughout your message, but it was clearly a Christian-centered message, a God-centered message. And yet people were widely with what you were saying. So I can vouch from my limited experience of watching these videos. It was remarkable. Do you have that sense then that people's Christian heritage was being reawakened by these events?
Absolutely, absolutely. Julian, what we're seeing right now is there is an awakening. There's an awakening nationwide. I think it's worldwide. There's an awakening. And after that, I feel like we'll just see a revival, which we have been praying for years to come. And we so desperately right now, so desperately need strong spiritual leaders. We are in a leadership crisis. A lot of church leaders are afraid, very afraid, and bowing down to the government's demands and mandates and whatnot. And I think it's so important right now that people rise to the occasion. Like in Ottawa, I had the opportunity 3 Sundays in a row, I was able to preach from the platform of the truck that was parked right in front of the parliament.
Yeah.
This was a crane, a big crane. He was flying the flag. Amazingly enough, Julian, that truck was from our little town of Elmer, right where I was from.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That was coincidence. But anyway, maybe it wasn't coincidence, but we had the opportunity to preach. And like you said, it wasn't just preaching systematically through the book of John or Matthew or whatever, but we had to connect with the people, letting them know that we recognize what their cry is, recognizing that the mandates that the government has placed on the truckers are irresponsible. They are overbearing and whatnot, to connect with them. But at the same time, we were able to show them that Christ, that God is Lord of Lords, and Jesus is the way to salvation. I felt like it was an excellent opportunity to lead them to Christ and to show them that our nation must repent and get back to God.
Wonderful. And when you were praying for the police, as we've mentioned that a couple of times, I was trying to put myself imaginatively in your situation. I was thinking, wouldn't I be afraid to do that? How did you feel at that moment? Did you feel that you might be arrested?
So I didn't know how much I was putting myself in danger when I first entered through, like they had circled the whole thing. So I approached a circle of police and I tried to see if they would let me through there, and they let me walk through there. So I was shocked. So they let me through the first ring there. So now I was in the center of it. And then I saw a group of police standing a little further away. And I thought, I will just get closer to them and see how far they'll let me go. So I walked closer and closer and closer. And I was shocked in my own body. I was a little afraid what could happen. But at that moment, I guess God took over. So I just walked closer and closer till I was right close by them. And then I started speaking to them and told them, I said, officers, do you not value your God-given freedom above your job?
Yes.
Do you have children? What will you tell your children tonight? Would you not want to stand? I said, stand on the right side of history. This is your opportunity. This is your day. Then I just started praying, and I thought any given moment they would say, sir, get away from here. You can't do this. But they listened to it until I was finished. When I said amen, I turned around and went back, had one more opportunity of prayer right there at the front line there, and we left. Nothing happened to me. I didn't get arrested.
No. And I was wondering, watching that, what was going on in those people's minds, you know, because of the social situation. They couldn't just walk and join you, could they? But I did wonder what the effect of that would be afterwards, with God working in their spirits, you know.
So I saw, when I was preaching to them, or when I was speaking to them, I should say, I didn't really count it as a message, but when I was speaking to them, you know how, as a preacher, we know when God is dealing with people, you can tell that conviction is present. It was obvious.
Right.
It was obvious the way their behavior was, and they received it so well.
Okay, well, let's talk about the aftermath of this. The Sunday before last, you preached about this at your church, a very powerful sermon. And one of the things you said was that a lot of people would think that Justin Trudeau's administration had won, of course, by, you know, dispersing this. Clearly, he'd won. The administration had won. But you say, no, actually, he failed, and instead it was God who won. Why do you say that?
The reason I'm saying that is because the cry, the burden that this convoy came to Ottawa with far, far exceeded what the original thought had been of it. God heard their cry, and their message resonated with the world. And what happened here, something very special happened here that the government would never want to admit, but they were exposed. So I'm saying the burden that the truckers came to Ottawa with was to say, look, there's something corrupt there. There's something wrong with our government that they're putting this oppression on the people. And when they arrived in Ottawa and the 3 weeks that they were there and the way they were dispersed confirmed every bit of their cry. It confirmed exactly that, not just to the truckers, not just to the Canadian people, but to the whole world. It was confirmed that what's inside the parliament is corrupt, is oppressive, and that government is not the solution. And to make matters worse for the government, they then went ahead and locked people's bank accounts to just confirm, above everything else, confirm how much their oppression, how far their oppression reaches. So to me, the message was made. As a matter of fact, when the truckers, after 3 weeks we were there, I felt like telling the truckers, you can all start up and go back home. The victory is won. You have won the game. It doesn't matter what the government does with this, because we have to look at the bigger picture, not just at what happens right there in Ottawa. The bigger picture is that the government was exposed. And it was confirmed what we thought a long time, is that government is not the solution. That's why I would have preached. And one more thing, that this also confirmed that we cannot trust the system. We cannot trust them with our children. We cannot trust them with our money. And that we right now, worldwide, but let's speak for Canada, we right now must actively work on building communities, building communities of people that are self-sufficient, that can, that are self-sustained, that can help one another, just like we did in Ottawa. When they take the fuel, we were okay. When they took the food, we were okay. When they took the propane tanks, we were okay, because the community stood together. That's, that message resonated, and that message was achieved and completed. The victory was won.
And this is why you point to Revelation 18, where God, through John, says, come out of her, my people. Talking about, of course, Babylon, a symbolic of the evil system, the system that is against God. So you've just hinted at, well, I won't say ways in which, but you've hinted at an ideal there that somehow we should build community that is parallel to and separate from, insofar as we can, separate from the system. But a lot of people talk about that. How do we actually go about that practically? That's a very difficult question, isn't it?
It is. It is a very difficult question. And that message sparked a lot of questions, perhaps. But I think it's good if a message sparks questions. That means people are thinking. So I feel like that the Lord accomplished through that message what he wanted to accomplish, is that we must actively find ways. And I think we need to start. I don't think that we can start too small. What I'm saying is, let's start with the wherever we possibly can. First of all, we must stand together. We must find the like-minded people. We must find the oppressed and help to take the oppression away. We must start our schools, because our students are misinformed. They are educated in the wrong direction, because the government obviously will educate in our public schools. They will educate the students to their system, to their belief, to their narrative. And we cannot do that. We must get back to the Bible. Our schools must have the foundation, must have the Word of God as the foundation, recognize the supremacy of God, like our charter says. That's what we must turn towards. But it is a big job. It is no small matter, but we must start somewhere. And I hope that people are looking for ways, and I know they are. We, instead of our money being invested with the government and their government institutions, we must build schools, build community centers, buy farmland so that we can cook our own, grow our own, raise our own cattle, have our own meat that's not pumped full of chemicals and full of things. Anyway, those are just some thoughts.
Yes, absolutely. Are you speaking essentially to Christians in thinking of this, or are you speaking more widely to to everybody, that we should all somehow get off the grid as much as possible. And if that is the case, then how do we marry those two? That you were just talking then about specifically Christian solution in terms of, say, schooling, but then other people would say, yes, I want to get off the grid, but I may not necessarily want to have my children in an overtly Christian school. Have you thought through this possible tension here?
So, Julian, that is beautifully said, the way you just said it. And can I just tell you, in the last 2 years, so since this narrative started, in the last 2 years, we have done exactly, in Elmer, we have done exactly what I have been describing here. So in the last 2 years, I wish, Julian, I could invite you to our Sunday morning service in Elmer, little town of 7,000 people. I wish you could come and see what we're talking about. We have purchased our own farm. Uh-huh. We have our own little store. And we have people moving from Toronto towards Elmer. They don't have to move right into town of Elmer, just in the community. We're not asking them to do it, but people are streaming out of the big cities. People are moving closer, and people are coming for work evenings on the farm where we weed the weeds together. We have the strawberries there. We have our own school. We have our own little store. We just have started to build a community. And then on Sunday mornings, we have our church service and we invite people. And Julian, we have had miracles happening where people that have over and over, people come to me and say, Pastor, I haven't been to church in 20 years. I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know why I'm here, but something is drawing me. A church or Christian life, the Christian experience and community go hand in hand. And we won't even have to tell the people, look, you have to become a Christian. Mm-hmm. They are drawn to it because they see God. Like I said, in Ottawa, the truckers mm-hmm. are saying, where can I find God? What must I do to be saved? Mm-hmm. So I'm saying it automatically draws them there. We don't have to push them. We don't have to shove it down their throat like they say in Canada. We don't have to do that. But we can draw them by seeing, oh, and they remember that and they say, that's what my grandparents, they used to have a farm and they did this. They were self-sufficient. They were off the grid. Mm-hmm. We have depended far too much on the grid. We have depended far too much on the government. And this message goes to Christians, non-Christians, everywhere, people. Look for ways how to get off the grid because it's a trap. Mm. It's a definite trap.
Yes.
Now you don't need faith to believe what I'm saying because you just saw this. The whole world has just watched this, what happens. And of all places in Canada, of all places.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
It was an eye-opener. That's why I'm seeing again what a victory this convoy has brought for the world.
Yes, absolutely. I've said so many times to myself, oh, Canada. That little phrase has just come to my mind so many times. How is that possible?
Right.
It's quite incredible. You have connected or you are connecting with many people around the world in this kind of vision. Is that true?
That is correct. And I do not stand, I do not stand alone. I am connected. I am connected to a group of pastors. Our church believes in apostles, like Ephesians chapter 4 says. So I am connected with other apostles, and we are constantly reading, studying, praying together. We're worldwide. We're represented worldwide. And right now I'm in the United States. Right now I'm in meetings with the people, with the other apostles, and working on it, seeing what do we do next? How do we lead the people? Because this plea is worldwide. This cry is worldwide. As you know, Julian, there's a convoy right now heading from California to Washington, D.C., and Lord willing, tomorrow evening, I'm meeting them in Cambridge, Ohio, meeting the convoy, and they're carrying U.S. flags, Canadian flags, which means they are the message resonates with them.
Mm. Well, thank you ever so much. I'm very aware that you are very busy and we've come to the end of our allocated time here. And I don't want to keep you more because you've just made it very clear that you've got a lot on your mind and a lot on your plate. So thank you ever so much indeed, Pastor Hildebrandt, for coming on. It's been a wonderful experience speaking with you. And I thank you for your bravery and your commitment to God and to his people and to people in general, which is so clear from both what I saw online. And of course, from this conversation now, it is very evident that you love people and you love God. And your church website, as I say, is churchofgod.com, and you have other ways in which people can see what you were doing, particularly during those 3 weeks there on YouTube and on your Facebook. And I will put all those, of course, in the show notes so that people can find out about that. Thank you ever so much indeed, Pastor Hildebrandt. It was great to speak to you, and I hope that one day we'll be able to speak again to see how things are developing.
Mr. Charles, thank you so very, very much for having me. I greatly enjoyed it.
Show notes for this program can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com. Podcast music by the brilliant Anthony Ryjakov, attribution non-commercial share alike 4.0 international. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guest, Pastor Henry Hildebrandt, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.